these divergent pieces on the entanglement entropy that we have seen that they are local in the boundary and they are extensive. So it's, in general, it's some kind of integral of something that depends on the cutoff procedure and on the geometry and on the fields, etc. But it's localized on the boundary and is an integral on the boundary. So this already tells you the type of divergence that you can get, for example, for in different dimensions. For example, suppose you want to see whether you get a logarithmic divergence, log epsilon. So the coefficient will be, so, and you think, for example, that you are in D dimensions. So the dimension of the surface is D minus 2. And the coefficient of this logarithmic divergence is some integral, because let us think of a smooth region B. So it's an integral over the boundary of B of something times differential of x d minus 2. Right? So if this appears in the entropy, it must be the case that this is dimensionless. So you have to provide a quantity here that has the right dimensions to kill the dimensions of the integral. And suppose you have a theory that is conformal, that is a theory that does not have any scale. Sorry? Bigger letters, okay. Yeah. So, here I'm saying that the coefficient of the logarithmic term is an integral. So it's an integral over the boundary of the region differential of some coordinates x d minus 2, because d minus 2 is the dimension of the surface, of some quantity that is local, that I put it here like something. This is the coefficient, log epsilon. So this does not have dimensions. This, the logarithmic dimension will be compensated by something else. But here you have a something that, as this is the entropy, so it doesn't have dimensions, but it's an integral, so this does have dimensions, so this has to compensate the dimensions. And then you have to find out some local quantities with the right dimensions to kill the dimensions of the differentials. And if you have, for example, a conformal theory that does not have masses, does not have intrinsic scales, the only thing that you can put there is something that is intrinsic to the surface, for example, some curvature. But you know that curvatures are tensors, local tensors, that generally have dimension 2. So the dimension is 2. So you can put here some curvature or some curvature or curvature square or some power of the curvature, some k, power of the curvature. So you can kill this dimension only if d minus 2 is equal to twice k, where k is an integer, right? It means that you will get, for smooth surfaces, you will get logarithmic divergences only for even spacetime dimensions.
What about the extrinsic curvature?
Extrinsic curvature also have two dimensions, right? So you can put, here I'm putting this R is generic curvature. It can be the curvature of the surface itself, or if you put in a manifold that has curvature, it can be the curvature, the volume curvature of the manifold. If you have masses, then you can put some masses here. But in general, the difference is that in that case, these R's, when are integrated over the surface, will give you some number that will scale with the size of this region, will not scale at all, right? Because, for example, if this is extrinsic curvature, it will not scale because this will go down with the size, and this will go up with the size in the same form. So this number will be just a pure number. But if you put a mass then this term will be proportional to the area. So for example, in four dimensions, you will have something like area times mass squared for a free field, some log epsilon. So what I mean here is that understanding this local nature of the divergences, you can already, without doing calculations, understand what type of terms you can get in different dimensions. So this is the first commentary. And the second one is people ask why the mutual information has to be divergent when these things touch each other, for example, A and B. But then you can have a general argument. Suppose that now that instead of putting this B, I'm putting B as the outside region. So B is all this. With some separation that is epsilon. And I first go to the continuum limit. Then I have a mutual information, AB, that is finite and depends on this epsilon, right? But this is the entropy of A plus the entropy of B minus the entropy of AB. And if you think that the global state is pure, you can have an heuristic argument saying that in the limit that epsilon is going to be very small, B is just the complementary set of A, so they have the same entropy. So this will give you some SA, let's say. And in the limit where epsilon is going to zero, A union B is going to be the full space. So at least the universal long distance entanglement of this quantity will go to zero because it's like the entropy of the full space is a pure state, it's zero. So heuristically, you can say this is going to zero. So this will give you 2SA. Of course, this is divergent. So this has to be divergent. But the nice feature, so you can think mutual information in this way as a regularization procedure for entanglement entropy, but it's purely geometrical regularization. And in fact, you would get some expansion in powers of epsilon very similar to the one that I have written for the entropy. But now, all the coefficients are universal. All the coefficients, the area term, the logarithmic term, all the powers that you get are having coefficients that are completely universal. It depends on the specific way you put this surface here. But if you take a distance epsilon, it's just a number. So this means also that at least has some answers to the question. We said how to extract the universal part, the universal information, the information that is belonging to the continuum theory from the entanglement entropy. And we said, well, one way is doing mutual information. And this tells you somehow that all the information that can be, that is universal in the entropy will be reflected somewhere in the mutual information. So mutual information really is the quantity that contains all the universal parts of the entropy. It's a heuristic argument, but you can see from there that if there is something in the entropy that is universal, you can also obtain it from the mutual information, for example, logarithmic term, all that. So let me then continue with a replica trick. We have arrived to a formula for the density matrix, the reduced density matrix in a region that is the following. So we have said that the density matrix in a region V in this Schrödinger like representation will depend on two fields. Uh, And this is a path integral e to minus the action, Euclidean action, in Euclidean space, and with boundary conditions that phi at time 0 and some point x is equal to phi 1, phi 2 in relation B, and phi x 0, 0 coming from below, so 0 minus I will write here, and 0 plus is equal to phi 1 B. So the picture was that we have a full Euclidean space with a cut along the region of B, so this is B, and then we have we can approach the cut from two sides, and the boundaries are phi 2, the boundary values of the field are phi 2x and phi 1x. And once you compute this integral with these boundary conditions, you get the value of the density matrix for these two entries. Now, this formula is interesting in itself. We will derive some consequences from this. But let me come back to the Renyi entropies. So we have to compute the powers of this matrix and then make the trace. So for example, let us compute trace of rho square. So rho square, so it's, I put rho b, phi 1, phi 2. If I, I'm putting another row, row B, I put phi 2, phi 3, because I'm multiplying two matrices. And then, in order that this is a matrix multiplication, I integrate over phi 2 in the region B. So this is represented in the path integral, saying that you have two copies now with two cuts. Then I'm putting phi 1 here. Then I'm putting phi 2 here, this. And I'm equating the field here to the field here. So these are identified. So these two copies of the manifold are identified in this cut, upper cut here, lower cut here, and upper cut here. And then I put phi 3 here. So the entries of this matrix is phi 1 and phi 3. So again, this is integrated over the field in this cut that is identified. So it's like a path integral in a full manifold with two copies. But now it's a manifold where if I come from here, I end up in this other copy. I change copies. And then if you take the trace is simply equating the first index with the last index. So I put phi 1 equal to phi 3. So this is a rho square. The trace of rho square is just the integral so the first is equal to the last one, so it means that now we have to say that this boundary is equal to this boundary and make the path integral in the full manifold respecting these boundary conditions. So the manifold now is glued along these cuts in this particular way, and it's a manifold that is only one piece, so it's not separated into pieces, but has some special topological structure. And you can do, again, the same thing with more copies, for example, three copies. So you identify this one with this one with this one, and the last one with the first cut here. And the path integral will give you the traces of powers of the density matrix.
Question?
Yeah? Yeah.
And in terms of the expectation value of operator,
right,
localized within the region A,
yeah,
that was sort of better definition because it didn't involve cutting.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there a similar definition for this new computation?
Somehow, this computation already has the fact that you have the path integral outside is like tracing out, will provide the right in this when you do the path integral will provide the right expectation values of operator in the region. So is implemented here in this way. So the path integral is giving you the expectation value, the right expectation value. Right? So but it's not something. So it give you the traces of power density matrix and the expectation values. You can compute just putting operators there, but it's not that you start from the expectation value and you get the entropy, right? Give you the same at the same time the two things. Okay, then let us see what is the topology of this manifold, what is happening here. So in order to do that, let us draw this diagram. Let us see what happens in this case, that is trace of rho square. So if I suppose I want to see what is the topology that these cuts are producing, then I can start from some point. Let's call it point one. And let me follow some curve, let's say a circle. In this way, when I touch this cut, I end up in the other copy. So I will end up here, and I get to the second point, let's say point two. And then from point two, I can go back, cross the cut, and I will end up again in the same copy. This is again the second cut marked by two crosses. So I end up here and come back to the original point. So when I did this curve, I crossed copies, but still I have a circle that has 2 pi times r perimeter. So the guy that lives here and do this does not notice anything strange. So near the cut, if I'm near the cut, I'm doing something like that, I see the usual topology of flat space and nothing else. But what happens if I start here and then I do this? So I enter the cut with only one cross and I go out from the cut that has only one cross and again turn around. I don't meet the first point. So I enter the cut with the 2 crosses and end up here and finally meet again the point one. So when I ended up the full thing, I have given twice the perimeter that I have followed is twice the perimeter of a circle. So this means that there, in this point, there is a singularity, that is a conical singularity, where the angle, as I go around, is instead of being 2 pi, is twice 2 pi. And in general, if you have this manifold, you can do the same, and you will realize that there is a conical singularity. Of 2 pi n, where n is the number of copies, that is located on the boundary of the region, on the boundary of B. Here is a single interval. This is the boundary. So, but the rest of the space is has n copies, but locally they are smooth flat surfaces. In particular, for example, keeping this point intact, I could deform here the surface and do the same everywhere and identify points, and I will end up with the same, exactly the same topology and the same manifold and the same partition function, the same trace. So it does not depend really on the position of the cut, but only on the position and the singularities, conical singularities on the boundary. So this is then the way one computes in quantum field theory the replica trick that give you, so the final answer is that these traces of rho to the n in the region B are equal to the partition functions of this n replicated manifold with this special topology. But this is not normalized, so you have to normalize in such a way that for one copy, you have a trace of rho is equal to 1, so you divide by set 1. But as you multiply by n times the density matrix, this normalization constant is to the power of n. So this is the answer. From there, you can obtain the Rengi entropies just taking the log of this quantity and divided by 1 minus n. So Sn is equal to 1 minus n here. The log of this is log Zn minus n log Z1. Great. Then we have an expression that has a nice feature that is very geometrical. In general, it's complicated to compute because it's a partition function in a replicated manifold, but it's very geometrical. And this has the key on how entanglement entropy can be computed in holographic, in holography in terms of some geometry, something geometric. Yeah. No, no, rho does not in general commute with the energy.
So, for example, if you have any moment that just right below the cut, can you move it up?
No, what I think is the in the real time, what this means is the following, I think. It's an expression of the following. If you have now it's real time, so you have this region. And then you can compute the Rengi entropies of the entropy of this region B, and it will be the same as computing the entropy of this other, any of these other surfaces, Cauchy surfaces for the same region. It will be the same. why? Because you can say that you have a full global state, and in order to obtain the density matrix here, you trace the global state over this piece of the Cauchy surface that is outside, B bar. So when you trace this, you obtain the same for all this. So it's the same density matrix, right? It means that another way to say that is that the algebra of operator, the state, if you think in the Heisenberg representation, your state is just fixed, doesn't depend on time. And then you have operators, for example, phi x, that you sit it here, and you write the algebra of operator here in terms of these fields. But these fields, in general, can be written as combinations. For example, in a free field, it's easy to write down this linear combination of fields here in terms of the Green function. But in general, in interacting theory, we don't know the explicit expression, but we can think that you can always write the operator here in terms of the algebra of operator here that is inside the causal cone. So It means that the density matrix, when you think, when we think that the density matrix is a function of some spatial surface B, some piece of a spatial surface B, in fact, is a function of any spatial surface. It's the same thing of any spatial surface inside the causal diamond, the causal completion of this region. The right way to say that is that the entropy or the density matrix, the Renyi entropies, are functions of the algebras, and the algebra of this surface is the same as this one, so is the algebra is a function of the diamond. The idea is that the algebra is a function of the diamond, then you have a state, and you compute the entropy of some algebra and a state. The entropy is a function of the relation between these two things. The algebra operators and its expectation values given by the state. Zn. Zn is just this partition function in this manifold. So it's the path integral of the exponential of the action in this manifold that has this particular boundary conditions. That the field here has to be the same as the field here in the as you go to the boundary. This is what I have shown, because I showed that the density matrix itself can be written as a path integral here, and then if you multiply and take the trace, you get that. Okay? Okay, but then let us make some comments about this thing, this what we can learn about this replicative, what it teaches us. The first thing that you can see is that, so it's nice that it's a path integral, right? So, but the meaning of this is important that this representation in terms of path integral can be done only for n integer. You cannot put, I'm making explicit what is this manifold, as the mathematicians do, saying that this is identifying with this, but this is rho squared, this is rho cubed. If I have a rho to two-thirds, I don't know what to put, right? So this is only for n integer, and this has a relation with the fact that this traces of rho to the n are, in fact, operator expectation values, some operators. Operator expectation values in a theory that is replicated n times. This was discovered by Calabresi and Cardi, and the way you can say that this is correct here is a little bit involved, but the idea is that when you can say these are numbers, right? When you can say that numbers are expectation values of operators, well, not all numbers are expectation values of operators because expectation value of operators satisfy certain positivity relations. For example, if I take O dagger, this expectation value has to be always positive. So these positivity relations, If you find these positivity relations in these traces, then you have that these traces are provided by expectation values of operators. And here, these positivity relations, this is a positivity relation in real time, but as you go to the analytic continuation to the Euclidean time, this is written in a different way, is that the fact that you have some operator here, and then you have to take the reflected operator. Oh, it's the same. Let us. So suppose something like this. So So I take the time reflection along some axis, and then this object has to be positive like this. So this is called reflection positivity, and it's a Euclidean version of the normal positivity of operators. And anything that you can put in the path integral will always have this property that this is positive. This path integral will be positive. Because the path integral is the path integral of this up to here times the path integral of this up to in the other half. So it's a product of two things that are complex, conjugated one of another, and this will be always positive. So, you can see from the result of the replica trick that for any integer, these objects are always expectation values of operators. These are called twisting operators, and some people in condensed matter also call them swap operators. And we can see that this is more general that quantum field theory. In ordinary quantum mechanics, you have the same. In quantum mechanics, you can think now that you have a system that is bipartition. And then you have n copies. You have to make n copies in order to express the traces of rho to the n as a expectation values operator. So your state that originally is some pure state, you can write it as a tensor product to the end of these phi i's. And then you can, in order to provide this operator that whose expectation values are the traces brought to the end, you can use a basis of these two Hilbert spaces such a way that the full basis is so this is the basis of the full Hilbert space. I is the number, is the replica index. And then you can just check that the right operator for A, let's say, N, these N copies, is equal to the tensor product over all the copies of the sum over the base of EAI plus 1. Times the identity in B. So this is like a swap operator. This operator can be written in any quantum mechanical model, and you have that trace of rho A to the n is equal to the expectation value of OAN. And it has another interesting property that OA, first, another property is that this quantity is a unitary operator. And you have that is ON V1 union V2. Suppose you have two regions, this will be the tensor product of OB1 OB2. So the fact that these traces of rho to the n are expectation value operators is very interesting from the point of view of quantum field theory itself, because it's like there is a non-local operator. This is non-local. It lives on the region, let's say. But it can be defined for any theory. It's like a Wilson loop that is purely geometrical and can be defined for any theory. Of course, it's a replicated model. For each replicated model, there is a different operator. Another interesting consequence of this is the fact that as is an expectation value of operator, this, contrary to the case of the entropy, this is a something that can be measured, something that can be measured in quantum mechanics, and some people have recently measured the rangy tooth, I think, in some particular models of in some particular physical system in the laboratory. No, no, no. Sorry?
It's an expectation value in that state.
Yeah, in the state. And the state, in order that is the trace of rho to the n, the state has to have this replicated structure, right? It's the same, it's a product of the same state in any of the copies. Yeah, you have to build up this replicated model, the replicated state, and then measure the thing. Let me then draw some interesting results from the way that the density matrix is written as a Passy integral. In general, this is complicated. You have the space, and you have a cut, and then the density matrix is the path integral on this the thing with some boundary condition here. But suppose that you let me draw the space in a more circular way. Suppose you have something like this, and you want to compute the density matrix of the half a space. Let's say take a plane here and then take the full half a space on one side. Then the density matrix is given by the path integral here with some boundary conditions, phi 1, phi 2. And then so this rho phi 1, phi 2 will be given by these path integrals. But now you can interpret this path integral not as usual as with the usual, let's say, time evolution. But suppose now that you want to go from this phi 2 to this phi 1, then you can foliate the space with these right lines or planes. And the evolution operator between this this surface to this one is just the angular momentum. So you have the angular momentum is the evolution operator between this and this one. So you can write this as the expectation value of this phi 1 e to the minus the angular momentum that is always the same operator because it's conserved. So it's the angular momentum times the parameter that is 2 pi. It's 2 pi So and from that, what is the angular momentum in the quantum field theory? In this Euclidean version, you have to put is the angular momentum is distance times the momentum of the field in this direction. So the angular momentum will be the integral of over the surface. Let's say x1 greater than 0. X1 is this coordinate. And here I put the differential of the spatial coordinates. X1, because it's the angular momentum, is distance times momentum. And the momentum in this direction, the momentum density in this direction, is T00. It's the energy momentum density, energy momentum tensor in the time direction in this case. So then this means that the density matrix, this you can see as the wave function representation of the density matrix, just taking the bracket between these two states. So this is the density matrix. The density matrix, in an operator sense, is e to the minus 2 pi. The 2 pi comes from there. Integral for x1 greater than 0 of x1 t0, 0. Zero. Might be, but for doing that you have to regularize. So if you regularize the theory, you put a cutoff, then you can put the trace of rho to equal to 1. But in general, this in the continuum itself is a cutoff dependent number. Right? This normalization will not converge. It's an infinite quantity. You can always write a density matrix as some e to the minus some h operator, where something like writing the density matrix as a thermal one. And this is because this is just a positive definite and Hermitian. So the only requirement for this is just to be Hermitian. And this is positive definite. So you can always write like this. And this h is called modular Hamiltonian. Some people call it also entanglement Hamiltonian. And in this case, the result is that the modular Hamiltonian is this local operator. Is the modular Hamiltonian is 2 pi. Zero, zero. In fact, in the real time, this in the Euclidean time, this was the generator of rotations. In real time, this is a generator of boost symmetry. But you have to integrate only in half a space. So this is very interesting because it's telling you the structure of the density matrix for half a space depends on something very universal. This derivation is for any theory, massive or massless. So it's very general and it's local. So it's an integral of some local operator. And in general, if we want to the result for some other shape on any theory, in general it will be something that is non-local, something that depends on products of operators all inside the region, this Hamiltonian. And will not be as simple as that. And this has many consequences. This, in mathematical sense, this was first discussed by Bisognano Wichmann. So it's a theorem that can be proved in axiomatic quantum field theory. And it's a paper, a very old paper of 75. Sorry? Without the H? OK. Another connection of this result is given by the UNRU temperature, the UNRU paper, that is a year later than this one. But the connection between these two things, I think people made it long time after that. And what UNRU said that was that an accelerated observer in Rindler space, so you have now Minkowski space. You have this is a half space. This is the causal wedge of this half space, and then you think you have an accelerated observer that has this trajectory here with constant acceleration. And you can see that the acceleration is equal to 1 over this distance here. Let's call it r. So for a constant acceleration, you have that the acceleration is proportional to the inverse of this distance. And in fact, the constant acceleration trajectories of an observer coincides with the trajectory of boost translations. So this guy that lives in this trajectory can think that his own time is the boost time, the time provided by boost. So he can think that his time translation operator is given by e to the minus 2 pi to the minus k, let's say, where k is the boost time. So this is his time translation operator, where k is the boost operator. That is just this integral here. So when this guy looks at the vacuum state, he sees that the vacuum state in this wedge is, in fact, provided by this expression. So he can think it's thermal with respect to this, to his own time. And if you look at locally, he will see a temperature that is proportional. This is distance to the boundary. So the temperature will be proportional to the inverse of the coefficient here of 2 pi x1. So he can think the temperature is 2 pi x1, or r, let's say, to the minus 1, which is equal to the acceleration over 2 pi. So this is a result by Unruh, and it's very much related to Bisognano-Wichmann theorem. What's the time? How much I have? 40 minutes, okay. Let me make some comment about this. Because it's interesting that you can see that this particular, if you have a Hamiltonian, say, so if you put the density matrix in this way, then you can invent a time evolution that is provided by E, the exponential, imaginary exponentials. So this is a time evolution that is provided by the imaginary exponential of the density matrix, and it will be given by e to the minus I t h. So it's like the time evolution provided by the model Hamiltonian. This flow that we can see here, because it's, in this case, the model Hamiltonian is the boost operator. But an interesting consequence of this is that you can describe, in fact, this density matrix we have seen that need regularization, but you can describe, instead of talking about density matrix, you can talk about these unitary operators, the unitary flows, in the following way. You can say that some operator in your algebra, you define time translation of your operator in your algebra as UT dagger, so the unitary transformation. And you can see that all the expectation values of these operators are given by traces of rho of UT O UT dagger. And as this operator commute with the density matrix because they are just functions of the density matrix, then they disappear from here. So this is equal to the expectation value of O. It means that that this unitary operator acts inside the algebra and is a symmetry. It maintains the expectation value of the operators. So this symmetry is another way to express the existence of, this density matrix, but has the nice feature that this symmetry, if you see here, you have a rho it, rho to the minus it. So the normalization problem that he was talking about will cancel here, because some constant will be with a different sign in the exponent will kill each other. So this is independent of your regularization. This modular flow, this flow of the modular time, is completely independent of any regularization, and it provides a way to describe what is the density matrix in without any regularization. So this is the way people, serious people that do not use the cutoff, like Bisognano, Wichmann, define it and prove these things. There is another requirement. So we have that there is a unitary operator, unitary one-parameter group that keeps the correlators invariant, and but not all unitaries that keep the correlators invariant are giving you the modular flow. There is a further requirement that is called the KMS condition. That is simply following from this simple calculation. Suppose you have now two operators, one O2, and this O2, I will move it in time, so I will put time, but now I put some imaginary time. And this imaginary time is minus I. So if I compute this, this is O1, this is a trace of rho to the minus h, sorry, of rho e to the minus h, O1. And then if I put here this imaginary time and replace it here, so I get e to the minus h, O2, e to the h. And then the trace, I can put it here, so it will kill this. And I can rearrange this to put it there. So this is the expectation value of O2, O1. So this is the KMS condition. It tells you that there should be some symmetry on your algebra that keeps the correlation invariant. And also this symmetry, this symmetry group, one parameter can be analytically continued to imaginary time in such a way that this this periodicity condition holds. So the way people show this in this that in this case of the half space, this this is the boost group. So you have to prove that there is an analytic continuation of the boost translated operator in such a way that this condition holds. And this can be done in a much similar way as a CPT theorem is proved. So let me come back to an application then of this result. Any questions? This particular modular Hamiltonian that is there for any theory can be used to prove the Bekenstein bound. So I will introduce first what is the Bekesen bound, what were the problems that people faced in trying to understand the meaning of this bound, and how the solution involves entanglement entropy and this particular modular Hamiltonian. So Bekesen bound is, it was proposed in 1981 by Bekesen. By doing some thought experiment in black hole physics, classical black hole physics, is suppose you have a large black hole, it's a black hole, and you have a proof piece of matter that is very small and situated at some distant r from the boundary, from the horizon, and you keep it there fixed, and this piece of matter has some energy E in the rest frame. And then this is very small to see, perhaps, R, E. And then the second step is you release this matter, and it goes through the horizon of the black hole and disappears behind the horizon. So this is step A, and B, you have a black hole that is a little bit bigger now because it has eaten the matter. So the radius and the area has changed. And the idea is to apply the generalized second law that say that thermodynamical black hole entropy area over 4G is a normal entropy. So the ordinary second law has to apply here. So you have in the initial case, you have that the entropy is the entropy of the black hole plus the entropy of the object. That can be something that you don't know. And in the second case, the object has disappeared behind the horizon, so you get that black hole entropy prime. So this one was the initial area over 4G, and this one will be A prime over 4G. So the generalized second law means that this quantity has to be bigger than this one, so that the entropy of the object is less than the variation of the area of the black hole over 4G. But now you can use the fact that the area is some geometrical quantity that depends on the metric, and the metric will react to energy and compute for perturbatively what is the variation of the area for this small probe to go inside. And this has a general result that this variation of the area is equal to 2 pi energy times r, where this is r is the distance and the energy of the object. So this follows from Einstein gravity. And what you get now is something that if you put all the units, all the dimension is h bar c. So this is Bekesen bound. And as gravity is universal, it means that this bound should be universal for all kinds of matter. So it's something like, it's important that this does not depend anymore on the G Newton. So it's something that, in principle, does not depend on gravity, even if it was derived through gravity. So the interesting consequence is that maybe this was some kind of inequality that any matter has to satisfy, and this is a new inequality coming from black holes, physics, and gravity. So from the beginning, the people try to understand this, and you can see easily that this inequality will be satisfied for most of the cases. For example, for if you put, for example, some box with thermal entropy, this entropy will be proportional to T to the d minus 1 times the volume, while this energy times r will be proportional to the volume times t to the d, because it's energy, not entropy, so it has a different power, times r. So you, this will be, you need that this is small, but then you can see that this this cannot be true if the temperature is less than r to the minus 1. So, but in that case, you can say, well, in that case, the wavelength of a typical excitation, of thermal excitation, will be bigger than the box. So I have to consider the box, et cetera, et cetera. So in order to test, it's important that for high temperature, there is no problem with this bound. So it's the bound mainly provides some constraint on things that are low temperature with respect to the typical sizes. This was very well known at the time of when he proposed the bound. But suppose now that you forget about the derivation and you want to see if this is correct in flat space in quantum field theory, then you immediately run into some problems like this one, like how to define how I define correctly the thing when, for example, the typical wavelength is of the order of the radius of the system is bounded to. So the problems, the first problem then is what is, because in flat space you can define energy and you can define the entropy. These are global quantities, but then what is the meaning of R for a general system? So it means that you maybe have some boundary condition, something like that. What is the meaning? What is R, let's say? This is if you don't localize the system, you have a meaning of E and S, but then R is not well defined. But if you localize the system in such a way that R is well defined, then what the entropy is, we have seen the entropy has, the entanglement entropy is divergent. So S is divergent. And it's incompatible with this inequality. And another problem that people thought always that it was the hardest one was called the species problem. That suppose that this is obeyed for one field and some state, then if you now think that you can make copies of this theory, that non-interacting copies of the theory, you can easily provide examples where you can keep the, and you now write a state for the full Hilbert space of these n copies, you can easily provide examples where the energy is kept constant while the entropy will increase logarithmically with the number of copies. So in principle, with a large enough number of copies, you can always violate this. Because of the volume of phase space available when you increase the number of copies increases. And the last problem here is that if I have some kind of localization, the energy is not necessarily positive. The energy, the expectation value of the energy density in quantum field theory can be negative. So the energy can be negative if it's localized. So this T00 can be negative. So this part could be negative, but this entropy is always a positive quantity. So again, you run into problems. So in order to solve these things, we have to revisit the derivation, let's say, but thinking that there is entanglement. Already in the vacuum, there is entanglement. This was the key the key idea of Marov, Minik, and Ross, that when you drop the objects behind the horizon, it's not that there is nothing outside, but there is still entanglement of the vacuum, they say. So you can think that this black hole is very large, so you are going to look at the near physics of the horizon, and this is the same as putting Rindler space in flat space and dropping an object across the Rindler horizon, the boundary of the half space. So it's a flat space problem, and then you can think that before and after the object crosses here, you have entropies. The first one is the entropy of the full space with the object inside, the full half space with the object inside, and the second entropy that you obtain is just there is nothing except vacuum here. So, but still there is an entropy. So the right quantity to put in the left-hand side of the inequality is the variation of entropy. The entropy of the object in the region V, let's say, minus the entropy of vacuum in the region B. And then what to make of the second, the right-hand side of inequality, you can write something that is similar to this, but is better defined in quantum field theory, that is just 2 pi the integral of the distance to the boundary times t 0, 0. So the right-hand side, you can write it as 2 pi integral expectation value of t 0, 0. And this is well defined. It doesn't need anything else, no boundary, no boundary condition, et cetera, to be computed. And in fact, if you revisit the original derivation of Bekenstein bound, the way this term comes about is through the first law, and the first law is related to the Killing energy of the geometry outside the black hole, and the Killing vector there is proportional to this quantity here. So this is the right quantity that follows already from Bekenstein thought experiment. So this is nice. Now we have this kind of quantum version of the Bekenstein bound. And we can see before trying to prove it that all these problems are solved. For example, what is the meaning of R? There is boundary condition. There is no problem with that. S is divergent. No, it's not anymore divergent because now we have a subtraction here through the entropy of the object combining to vacuum fluctuations, you subtract vacuum fluctuations, and this is finite. The species problem was telling that keeping this constant, if you increase the number of species, the entropy here can be made to grow logarithmically with the size of a number of species. But then when you do that, this part will also grow because it's a vacuum. We also have more entropy, the reduced density matrix, and then you can see, and we will prove, in fact, that this quantity is, in fact, always, like, bounded. It will not grow forever with n. The fact that the energy density can be negative, still here, this right-hand side can be negative, but now we have a subtraction here, so it can also be negative. So it means that in order to the bound to be satisfied, if this is negative, the entanglement of the object has to reduce the entanglement of the vacuum. Okay, and then the proof is very simple because, but in order to do that, I will recall the relative entropy definition. So relative entropy between two states, let's say rho zero, rho and rho zero, was the trace of rho log rho minus trace of rho log rho zero. So it's a quantity that depends on now two density matrices. And now it will be useful to introduce here the entropy of rho zero sum and subtracted. So I will put it like trace rho log rho. Sorry? I'm what? Oh, there is an additional trace here, right? Yeah. Well, trace of a number is one, right? So it was correct. trace log rho minus rho zero log rho zero plus rho zero log rho zero. So I'm not introducing nothing, this cancel. Minus rho log rho zero, right? And then, yes, it's better. It's better to put zero here and right there, okay? So, this is the end. Okay. This is correct. Yeah. So, this part is just entropies, no? This is minus the entropy of rho, and this is plus the entropy of rho zero. And this, let us call rho zero e to the minus h, where h is the modulo Hamiltonian of rho zero. So this logarithm is just minus h. So what I have here plus the expectation value of h minus the expectation value of h in the state zero. So this is trace of rho h minus trace of rho rho zero h, right? So we can write it more compactly as saying that this is the variation of the expectation value of the modular Hamiltonian minus the variation of the entropy. So this is the relative entropy, it's the same quantity, and this is always greater than zero. And from there you can see that it almost the same thing as we have here. The only thing that we have to provide is that IH is related to the energy density, and we have already proved that. So if we use as rho zero the vacuum density matrix of half a space, then immediately you get the Bekenstein bound from there. So it's equivalent to the positivity of relative entropy for two particular states in any quantum field theory. Yeah. Yeah, it's the same as this one. So I'm introducing here this and the opposite, so cancel. But then I'm using these two to make the subtraction of the entropies. And these two, I converted log rho zero to minus h to get this thing. This is a interesting because it somehow tells you that even if Bekenstein bound is compatible with black hole physics, it does not provide, black hole physics does not provide something new to the Minkowski space-time quantum field theory. It can be proved with just special relativity and quantum mechanics. Yeah.
Just argued recently that the notion of entanglement in entropy
I would say that I don't believe that. So for example, what I say is that it's not that the entanglement metric, of course, is badly defined for any quantum field theory. But relative entropy is well defined. And this is a relative entropy. And if, for example, if you take a chiral, this is the case, right? So it's a chiral mode of a free fermion, massless fermion in 1 plus 1. Then you can define relative entropy of two states for some interval of the null, of the null. Well, you can say you can say that this is the Bayesian bound is just positivity of relative entropy that is well defined, and then your question would be: is always possible to split relative entropy as a subtraction of two quantities that each one is well defined? This is less perfectly understood because especially people in algebraic quantum field theory haven't thought much about that. But in all examples that we managed to do that, it's perfectly correct. In particular, for chiral fermion, I can do that, and it's finite. Both terms, there is no problem. Sorry? The Hilbert space do not factorize even for spatial in the continuum limit. Does not factorize.
I mean, one way to say it
I understand. I don't think this is correct. I don't think because it's true that, for example, for the chiral fermion in the interval, null interval, if you just make a boost of something, then the entropy will change, but the difference of entropy of two states will not. This is perfectly finite. Okay, well. Okay. okay, then. I want to emphasize something that is quite interesting that it comes from here. It's not just the proof of Bayesian bound, but it's the interpretation of this thing is completely somehow. Is when you have, an object that is far away and has a lot of energy. Far away from the boundary, has a lot of energy in such a way that it can be differentiated from Buckley fluctuations very well. Then you obtain the initial interpretation of Bayesian bound, and everything, this part will be much bigger than this one. So there is no problem in that case, because you can say it's like in the thermal case, let's say. But the problem is when this object is a small deviation of vacuum, let's say it has a little energy, or it has a lot of species, or it's very near the boundary. In that case, this tends to saturate. And in that case, it means that the Bekenstein bound is not giving you, as the original Bekenstein bound, you can think this is giving me some bound on the number of degrees of freedom, something like typical, like things that come from gravity, saying that there is a bound on number of degrees of freedom, and then you cannot put too many. But this is not correct. What it bounds here is given by the interpretation of relative entropy, is the distinguishability between these two states, the state you are putting and the vacuum. So what it tells this is that in order to distinguish the object from the vacuum, such that the relative entropy is reasonably reasonably large, you have to put enough energy. You have to put enough energy there. So we see that at least this type of bound that we can understand well mathematically is not given some like holographic idea of cutting the number of degrees of freedom. So how much I have? 5 minutes, okay. Well, there is another consequence of this, that this is the inequality of the relative entropy, but now you can think what happens for small deviations. Suppose I want to compute relative entropy for something that is very near the vacuum, some state that is very similar to vacuum. So in that limit where Bekenstein bound is saturated, so you can think of the following. Suppose you have a state, rho 1, that depends on some parameter s, in such a way that when s equal to 0, this is just rho 0. So then you can draw the relative entropy in terms of this parameter s. And you will see that it's always positive, but relative entropy when the two states, so this is rho s, rho 0, when the two states are equal, when s is equal to 0, the relative entropy is 0. So you can see that this is like going up both sides. But if this thing is smooth, you can think it's smooth deformation of the density matrix, then it will happen that here, because of it's 0 and it's positive in each side, the first derivative is 0. It means that to linear order around the point where the two density matrices are equal, to linear order, you have that the relative entropy is 0. It means that these two quantities, the variation of the entropy and the variation of the modular Hamiltonian, both have to agree to linear order at that point. So it means that delta S is equal to delta H to linear order. And this is very interesting if you understand what is H, because it means that you can compute variations of the entropy that is complicated in general to compute in terms of variation of some operator, expectation value of operator. And here, for example, we have an explicit expression in terms of the energy. It means that, for example, variations of the entanglement entropy across a half space, when you perturb the vacuum, will be given by something proportional to the stress tensor. So this is called the first law. Of entanglement entropy. And it has recently had many interesting applications, especially to holography. But in principle, if you have the mind of saying, well, how can I compute the entropy that is complicated, this gives you some particular case where you can compute easily the entropy of something where you know the modular Hamiltonian, you just evaluate this expectation value and then you compute the entropy. That is very similar to the formula, is the same type of formula that you have of variation of entropy is equal to variation of energy divided by temperature in thermodynamics. And this formula is the way you can measure entropy, let's say, in thermodynamics. This is because we have said, how can you measure entropy that is not an observable? Well, you can measure variations of the entropy doing something like this, and here is the same. And if you pile up a lot of variations, then you can compute the entropy, let's say, using the first law. But of course, you have to understand what is the modal Hamiltonian each time you variate the new modal Hamiltonian, you variate the state. So I think I will cut here, and then if there is any question. Yeah, for large volume, thermal state for large volume, right.
Right, right. And energy, you can define by u state, d t, d is d d s, I think d.
Yeah.
That's the temperature value defined in trouble. So, but this derivative seems a bit removed from thermodynamic liberty. Here you're looking at ground state, and then derivative. Here you are, like,
yeah. Yeah, the case. No, no, the question is that the original attempts to check the Bekenstein bound always have a lot of ambiguities. Input, the input was ambiguous. In the case you say that you have a large system, thermalized, etc., the Bekenstein bound holds trivially. The right-hand side is very large with respect. Okay, okay, but then at some point, if you think in some bounded system, then the boundary conditions will enter, especially if you think that these large range interactions are important, then it means that you don't have volume law for the entropy, let's say. So it means that it will sense a lot the boundary conditions. And so it will be ambiguous in that sense, unless you define your restricted entropy doing this trace of the outside part, and then you can forget about any boundary conditions. You subtract vacuum, let's say, and then you get to something like this. So I can't see a different way to define it properly, especially in the limit where the bound is going to be saturated. Yeah, but the problem. I think the problem of that definition is that the way you define the states that you have there is not a Hilbert space. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You can. Right, that's correct. But then you have some energy well defined, some R well defined. But what is the entropy? The entropy.
Because you just take the global state and take trace of rho log rho for the global state.
Ah, okay.
So you just take, the S is the bottom of the whole thing. The energy is the expectation value of the energy, certainly not in the vacuum state. And R is just this region. I mean, I'm just saying that there is a way to have a well defined definition.
So you say a state localized in some region R is by definition something that has zero expectation values of what outside, of what?
No, I'm saying that the expectation values of any operator
Yeah.
The spatial array is exactly the same as
the vacuum. As a vacuum.
So you just require it to be the same as the vacuum. So in other words, outside it looks like the vacuum. Inside you put energy, you made it different from the vacuum. And of course there's entanglement between inside and outside. That's non-zero. I mean, there's certainly correlations. But if you just look at operators outside, you keep them exactly the same. But This is a well-defined, one well-defined thing, but it's not one that leads to a solution. Whereas your definition, you know, changing R from the time R to the interval,
yeah,
does reformulate the problem, so that it does that.
Okay. My naive question would be if there is a possibility that you can have some state with these properties, really, that all operators outside is equal to the vacuum.
Yeah, I mean, you just take smeared operators inside, and make a Hermitian combination of smeared operators inside this region, multiply by I exponentially. That's a unitary operator.
Yeah.
Apply that unitary operator to the vacuum. You get another state, and because all these operators, at least in the boson.
Because they commute and then they
commute outside. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Here are exactly the same.
Yeah.
So this is what occurs, you know, some excitation, it's a local excitation.
Right, yeah, it's a unitary inside, right. Right. Unitary inside.
Yeah, and then you can calculate the Bonhomian entropy, you can calculate the expected energy, and of course you are.
Right, yeah.
As that. So you can.
And you say that there is counter examples. There are counter examples that the bound holds.
No, I think basically you could get a very tiny, you could have this thing.
But
when vacuum and a slightly excited state, and if you have a problem, it's very, very small because the entropy has the log p in it.
But let me ask, because you said unitary inside acting on the vacuum will give you some property, but this has zero entropy, right? So
this
has zero entropy. Again, when you take a mixture, then the expectation value outside.
You take a bunch of these states.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but when you take a mixture, you are changing the expectation value outside.
No.
Sorry for interrupting now, but
yeah.
maybe you can discuss this
afterwards,
because as I'm going to tell you, the lunch break might be a bit short. So I have two more announcements to make, if I can get one more minute. But before I do that, let's thank Horacio again for a very nice lecture.